Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy. Welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of August 13th through 20th. I'm here this week with Father Jim McDermott, Associate Editor of America. Welcome, Father Jim.
Thank you, Tim.
Now, how you been, Father Jim?
Oh, I've been great. And actually today I am very excited.
Well, why are you so excited?
Well, this morning, you know, as my custom, I start work, I check my email box, and I had 150 emails.
150 emails. Well, you have a lot of friends.
This is the thing, and the crazy part about it is most of them I don't even know.
Really?
So I have all these friends, like new friends, which is like, it's like going to a new school, and you're like on the playground and meeting all these new people. It's amazing.
So who sent you these emails?
Well, so let me think. I got a couple from a family in Nigeria, and I think Abuja, maybe? I don't even know. I think it was Abuja.
Really?
Yeah, and they're actually having some financial trouble, so they were actually writing to see if I could help, which, I mean, I was thinking to myself, wow, I don't even know you, and you're reaching out for help. I just think that's amazing.
Okay, and what else have you gotten?
Well, let me see. Great thing. I don't know how this happened. I can get... You're not going to believe this.
Okay.
I can get a free iPod.
A free iPod.
The big ones, the like 80 gigabyte iPods, the ones that have the video screens. And all I have to do is fill out some survey.
That's the only catch.
I got to fill out some survey. How about that?
Really?
I don't even know how these people got my name, but I was like, sure, absolutely.
Now, what else have you received?
Well, let me think. There were a whole bunch. I didn't get to go through all of them, and I certainly haven't written them all back yet. But I will. Actually, the one that I did write back, I've been getting letters from this person for a while now. There's this lady, maybe I'll just deal with this right now in case she's listening. Melissa, it's very nice for you to get these emails. It's very nice for you to write. But I don't know. Maybe you don't know. I'm a priest, and I'm not available. I'm sure you're very nice. I'm sure you're a very nice woman, and someday you're going to find a very nice guy. But probably, you know, we should just stop sending them.
Now, Jim, this sounds to me like you're getting a lot of spam.
Oh, spam. Well, that's kind of a critical term for it, isn't it, Tim?
Well, I think...
What, do you like some techie? You're worried about your server?
No, I'm not an expert on these
things.
Throw
out all the lingo.
But I get a fair amount of these messages, too.
Really?
Yes, I do.
And so these are friends of yours?
No, this is just junk email. I mean, everybody gets these in their email box.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, that's funny. You know, actually, just screwing around here, right? Just being wacky for the audience at home. Yeah, I've sometimes gotten more than my share. In fact, we've talked about some of the people in our office getting...
Yes, some folks downstairs at the general email address for America Magazine get thousands of spam emails a day sometimes.
Yeah, and it's what made me think of this today was not only receiving them, but The New Yorker has a great new article on the history of spam. In the latest issue, it's actually the August 6th issue. It's an article by Michael Spector, and it's available online for free.
For free.
Free, free.
And
free.
It's called?
It's called Damn Spam.
Damn Spam. All right. And it gives you the history of...
It gives you the history, like how did this stuff begin, and it tells you a lot about why it is that it continues. Because, you know, I don't know about your computer, but mine, I have a million filters. I have all this stuff to try to block it out, and I still get, not only in my junk mailbox, but in my mailbox... I still get a ton of them every day. And it turns out, so here's one of the great things in this article. You know, we have certain keywords that we use to try to, like, keep things from coming into our mailbox. For instance, Viagra.
Ah.
Right, everyone gets these ads.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd think that if you put Viagra in your keyword list, that would be enough. But it turns out there are 600 quintillion.
Quintillion, is that a word?
I've just made that up. It's a lot. It's 600 million different variations on the word Viagra.
Wow.
If you use all the different keys and keystrokes on the keyboard.
Wow.
So it's not likely to be filtered out.
So this is a losing battle.
It is. And actually, you know what makes it a losing battle, Tim? Here's a little message for the folks at home, is that people respond.
Really?
People respond. The only reason that spammers continue to do this is because a certain percentage of people continue to like get sucked in. So, for instance, a great story in the article, one of the first real spammers that we know about was in the 1970s. And what this guy did, I think it was the 70s or maybe the 80s, this guy and his wife, they sent an email to millions of people saying that the green cards were going to end in 1984. There weren't going to be any more green cards after 1984, right? So within hours, their service provider shut them down for being fraudulent. But they got over 1,000 clients.
1,000 clients. All it takes is a minuscule percentage, and they make money.
That's all it does. And now many people listening, are probably like us, are sort of, you know, we're sort of spam immune. If anything, we're irritated by spam, but we just delete it and move on with our lives. But there might be some in our families who are more easily taken in.
Right. Who are perhaps a little more... gullible is not a nice word, but...
No, yeah. We've all got our weak spots, right? For me, to kind of... Actually, I have to admit the iPod thing's a weak spot. I saw that spam enough times that once I did try to get the free iPod.
And you didn't receive
it. No, and instead, I had to fill out a survey that went on forever and subscribe to free things, and then suddenly I was getting a lot more spam, and I never got to the end of the survey, so I never got the free iPod. This is the way it works. They wear us down.
They wear you down,
it's
and people
the evil
respond.
Spirit.
I do remember when I got that first message from the African businessman looking for money. I was a reporter at a major newspaper, and I was tempted to send it to our investigative reporter thinking, hey, this is a good story. You should look into that. Thank God I didn't. I would have made a total fool of myself.
So St. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits, likes to talk about having discerning hearts, and we should all pray maybe for good discerning hearts for all of us.
Exactly.
So now that's my little pop culture moment. What else? What's going on in the magazine and the web this week?
Well, we're here talking about the August 13th to 20th issue, and the cover story is about the 40th anniversary of the unification of Jerusalem, which followed the Six-Day War in 1967. And
I remember that.
Yes. I was too young. But with that article, there's a large selection of articles in the magazine, and with that we have an archive article from back in September of 2006 that Father Drew Christensen, our editor-in-chief, did on the situation of Christians in the Middle East, and that's called Alarm Bells in the East.
Hmm.
And as you know, Father Jim, this issue of the situation in the Middle East is a particular concern to our editor, Father Christensen, who served for many years on the bishop's conference on Mideast affairs, so this is a real passion of his.
A real passion, yeah. And I mean, I think if you look in the magazine the last couple of years, you've seen, I think, that passion play out with a real good focus and interest in that issue.
Now, another good article we have in this issue is a piece by Father Andrew Greeley.
Andrew Greeley.
Yes, perhaps you've heard of him. a regular contributor to our pages, has been writing for us since the 60s, I think, and a recent recipient of the Campion Award. And
That's
he has
right.
a piece... this week, talking about a new book, a new sociological study on Catholics and what they actually believe. And they rank the elements of the Catholic faith they consider the most important. And top of the list are issues like Mary, the Eucharist, so the important things. And lower down are issues of celibate clergy, abortion are not as important. So
that's to them.
To them, yes. And that's quite revealing. So we have an interview with Father Greeley on the web this week.
Nice.
Yeah, so that... That will be featured. It's probably already been posted. It will be posted soon if it is not. And also this week on the podcast...
We have to get through all the spam. It takes a long time.
Right, exactly. Also this week, we have an interview with Father Joseph O'Hare.
Tim, you've got all this good stuff
on... Yeah, good stuff.
Wow.
Father O'Hare is going to be... he's talking about the issues of campaign finance reform. You know, for many years, he served in New York City government as the head of the campaign finance board. So we talk a bit about the presidential election and all
nice.
The fundraising that's going on. So
nice. That's a lot.
Yeah, well, it's some good stuff we have.
Good.
Well, thanks for joining us, and hopefully you can come back again soon.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, take care.
All right.
Hello and welcome to the American Magazine podcast. I'm here this morning with Father Joseph O'Hare, Associate Editor of America. Welcome, Father O'Hare.
Nice to be with you, Tim.
Thanks for joining us. Now, Father O'Hare joined the staff of America again in 2003, but he served before as Editor-in-Chief of America. Now, when was that?
Well, I came back from the Philippines. I've been teaching in the Philippines, and I came back in 1972. And the editor-in-chief of America, then Father Don Campin, asked me to join the staff, which I did. And then 3 years later, in 1975, Don Campion was called to Rome to be head of the press bureau at the Jesuit headquarters. And then I succeeded him as editor-in-chief from 1975 until 1984. In 1984, I went up to Fordham.
Now, during your tenure here at America, what were some of the big issues that you covered?
Well, I think the one summer that stands out to me was the summer of 1978, when that was the summer that Paul VI died on August the 6th, and I remember we were rushing to write an editorial on his death. And then some younger Jesuits persuaded me that I should go to Rome to cover what was happening. I never thought of that, but I did go, and it was a great experience. I learned a lot about the Jesuits, about the International Press Corps, and then came back, and that was after John Paul I was elected, and then to everybody's great surprise, 33 days later he died, so went back again.
Of course.
So that period from August into October, my two trips to Rome certainly stood out for me as a very important period in America's life and in my life personally. Going back a little earlier than that, though, I'd say when I first joined the staff in 1972, one of the big issues was Richard Nixon and the Watergate.
Of course, right.
The Watergate break-in. And at that time, Nixon used to have people come into the White House to preach. Billy Graham preached a few times. So we wrote an editorial on Watergate that took the form of a homily, what we would have said if we were invited to preach at the White House, as people did. And it got some attention. And it was reprinted on the op-ed page of the Times, because if you recall, at that time, one of Richard Nixon's big spokespersons was a Jesuit priest, John McLaughlin.
Oh, of course, right.
Now of the famous McLaughlin group. So I think the Times was anxious, could they get a Jesuit perspective on the other side? So they printed our Watergate homily on the op-ed page.
And that was in 72 or
something? 72, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be a good article. Maybe we'll feature it on our archive section of the homepage one of these days. And then you went on to Fordham in 1984, and you were there for a number of years.
19 years until 2003.
Of course, and that was a busy time for you. In addition to your time at Fordham, you were also doing some work for New York City as well, right?
Yeah, I had Ed Koch, when he was mayor, had asked me to serve. In fact, even before I went up to Fordham, asked me to serve on a commission that he was putting together about investing funds in South Africa. So I had done a number of things that the mayor had asked me to do, and then they had this new a piece of legislation was going to create a campaign finance board to govern election spendings. People who opted into the program, who chose to accept the limitations, also got matching public funds. So I did that in 1988, and then I was we had a little controversy because we fined David Dinkins quite a sum of money, and Harold Ickes, who was one of his advisors at the time, was very angry. So David Dinkins, in the last days of his administration, appointed someone to succeed me. And then Giuliani, when he came in, vowed to reverse that and called upon the guy that had been appointed, Tom Schwartz, who embarrassingly enough was a Fordham Law alumnus. And all the editorial pages said that he had to step down so that I could be reappointed. So I served the original appointment from Koch, and then twice more by Giuliani. So 15 years altogether.
So until 2003, was
right.
it?
Yeah.
Okay. And your job there was to make sure that the candidates abided by the campaign finance rules?
Yeah. The program in New York City is that, first of all, it has to be a voluntary program. You can't, because of Supreme Court rulings about money being political speech, you can't impose limits. That's why self-finance candidates, there's no way that you can insist that they observe the contribution limits, although we encourage them to. But the program is one that candidates who agree to accept limitations on the contributions they accept, and also agree to certain very important disclosure requirements, identifying who their donors are, etc., will receive matching funds.
Okay.
One of the good things about the New York program is that after every campaign, we're mandated to have a review of how the campaign went and then make recommendations to the city council on how the program should be adjusted, more money given, less money given. One of the issues now that they're still trying to find a solution to is giving matching funds to candidates who are in non-competitive races where they don't really need the matching funds.
Right, so does that make sense?
It, yeah, it, it, But I mention that because any kind of campaign finance reform, you have to have a mechanism built in where you can review and revise the program, because candidates will find any loopholes in the program.
Exactly.
And that's the nature of the beast. You
right.
can do. So you have to have a continuing reform revision thing.
Of course. And now things have changed here in New York. We have a mayor who opted out of that program.
Correct.
He's
yeah.
a billionaire, Michael Bloomberg.
I think that I said in 2001, when Bloomberg got elected by a very narrow margin, and the issue was, did Mark Green have enough money to counter this tremendous blizzard of ads that Bloomberg had? And I think he did have enough. And that's a point of some contention between myself and Mark Green to this day.
Now we'll move to the national scene now, where we're already in the midst of the presidential election, and we're a good, was it 14 months before the election here,
yeah.
and it's been going on for several months already. Now, at this point, no candidate has chosen to take part in the campaign finance system.
Because they apparently feel they can't afford to. There's been a tremendous jump in spending in presidential campaigns, even over the last 4 years. The lead into the 2008 presidential election has been so long, candidates are being assessed by how much money they raise. There's a dynamic at work now in this presidential campaign that I think is relatively new, and it's very alarming. Just this morning I read something that Ed Koch said, that he thinks we ought to have a law that shortens the time for a presidential campaign, because whatever the answer to it is, we're out of whack with this.
Right. You know, campaigning begins, you know, if you're in office, you know, campaigning begins 2 years into your presidency, you know, which just doesn't make any sense. And we have senators who are spending full time campaigning. And
there's also a relationship between the amount of money spent and the quality of the campaign, because most of the money goes for television ads. And these are always short, snappy ads. I remember dealing with some people in the New York City local campaigns who said, if we got the local television stations to provide free time for a half-hour debate, would that preclude the necessity of buying all these television commercials? And the candidates said very, in all candor, they said, no, we'd prefer the short spots.
They don't have to explain their positions
yeah,
too much, just
yeah.
the short and sweet, that's what they want. Well, that's interesting. Now we're at a point now where the Democratic leaders in fundraising are Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And on the Republican side, Rudy Giuliani seems to be doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And his closest competitor right now, I mean, John McCain is sort of way behind at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
The question is, how long will this money last? Because they have a good 14 months to go.
Yes, also, and as I think with some of the candidates, as the public gets to know them better and better, they may lose some of their appeal. I think it's just a shame, though, that money is such an important factor, even now in assessing the viability of the candidates. And I feel particularly disappointed in John McCain's campaign, because I think when he ran the first time in 2000 against George W. Bush, he was a candidate who inspired a lot of enthusiasm from both sides,
mm-hmm.
Democrats and Republicans. When you think back, the two of the candidates there in 2000 were Bill Bradley and John McCain, and neither one of them got the nomination of their party.
Right.
But it would have been, I think, a very interesting campaign.
Sure, I think so, too. And, of course, John McCain was one of the leaders in the campaign finance reform on the national level.
Yeah.
And yet that doesn't seem to be, as you said before, these are laws that have to be continually revisited because people find all sorts of loopholes here.
Yeah.
And that's the case on the national scene as well. Good. Well, Father Joseph O'Hare, thanks for taking some time to speak about these issues with us, and hope you'll join us again.
Very good. Always good to talk to you, Tim.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine Podcast. We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast by clicking on the link on our homepage labeled Podcast. And there are directions there for downloading our weekly show via iTunes. We'd also like to thank Bill McGarvey, singer-songwriter, who provided the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.